Hey y'all, welcome to We Rebel.
I apologize quiet Sunday morning
in advance. Yeah. For the state of Nick and James.
Wait, whoa, I'm fine.
I'm fine too.
I disagree with both of you.
I'm perfectly fine.
I think we're good.
Michigan is in the national championship game tomorrow. We're all Wolverines. Yes. Some of us on the podcast might have had a little bit too much to drink.
Just
I'm not
going
to say who it is. I'll leave you to figure that out.
I think it'll be abundantly clear. Yes. One of us was working yesterday, but equally as excited.
Mm-hmm.
And then two of us were not.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I think the tone is coming from a little bit of a place of jealousy.
I understand, you know, because I normally work Saturdays,
yeah,
like all day. And so like I get it when you.
I'm really just trying to, you know,
yeah,
be honest with our listeners.
It's wonderful. It's also my mom's birthday. Oh. So happy birthday, Mom.
Which is much more important than what we're talking about.
Much more important. She's
happy
the best.
Happy birthday,
Cinzia,
to Nick's mima.
No, my mom. Not my mima.
What is a mima?
I don't know. It's grandmother. No, it's my mom.
Whatever.
My mama.
Your mama.
Your mama.
My
He's
mama.
Italian, in case you didn't know.
I've said it so many times on this podcast. Let's rock and roll. Things happened this week. Wants to kick us off with some
I
Russia?
I think James wants to kick us off.
I want to kick us off with... I'm nowhere near the microphone. Sorry.
There you go. You got it.
There we go.
Right,
we're back.
Sorry. I was just dealing with some other things. So we're going to talk about Russia first, guys, which I know...
Get it out of the way. Get it out of the way.
Excited about... So Russian diplomats... are expelled from the U.S. In a measure that I'm sure...
I'm sorry. Could I just tell our listeners I wish we could live stream your faces right now? Because you're both looking really good. Particularly Nick. Look at his face.
And the hair. It's really
and
the hair.
And the hair.
So talk about how these guys got expelled.
Yep. Sorry.
Let's get to the news.
Well, okay. So first of all, I just want to preface this all by saying we talked at length about how the sanctions had been passed.
Yeah.
But with overwhelming majority, we should implement them. Trump is like, no, I'm not doing it.
Uh-huh.
Then we find out last week, more than 20 countries have aligned with the UK, expelling more than 100 diplomats. Somehow US got involved with that. And it's like, well, Trump, if you really want to take a stance against Russia, why wouldn't you just impose the sanctions that everyone wanted you to impose? So anyway, it's the largest collective expulsion of Russian intelligence officers in history. This is a BBC News article. And so in this, it mentions that Russia vowed to retaliate to the, quote, provocative gesture, they called it. And they denies any role in the attack on Sergei Skripal and his daughter. You know, they were poisoned.
With nerve gas
a few weeks ago. Yulia in Salisbury, southern England. So it was the daughter's name. The pair remain in critical but stable condition in the hospital. So EU leaders agreed last week it was highly likely that Russia was behind the nerve agent poisoning. Mrs. May, the PM of England, correct? Theresa May. Said President Putin's regime is carrying out acts of aggression against our shared values and interests within our continent and beyond. And as a sovereign European democracy, the United Kingdom will stand shoulder to shoulder with the EU and with NATO to face down these threats together.
Well, I think too, can I jump onto this?
Yeah, please.
Yeah.
So later in the week, Russia it announced the expulsion of 60 U.S. diplomats, and the U.S. officials were among 150 Western diplomats thrown out by Moscow after 25 countries joined the U.K. in expelling Russian officials. This is from a Vice article by David Gilbert. Maria Zakharova, which she's a spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry, added that the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg would be shuttered. The White House released a statement on Thursday that said Russia's response was not unanticipated and the United States will deal with it. But we haven't heard anything from Trump. So I think it's just interesting that we've taken away their we've expelled diplomats based on this attack, which then they've denied, and then they've expelled our diplomats. And Trump, one, has said nothing about it. Mm-hmm. But also, I don't know, doesn't it seem a little childish on Russia's part? It's just like, well, if you do it to us, we're going to do it to you. It seems they're guilty. If it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, probably a Russian spying agency that with the express goal of destabilizing Western foreign powers.
I would think so. And what just scares me the most is that I mean, we're all, it's all pretty evident that Putin has his thumb over Trump. And so when he does little things like this, like, yes, he's expelling his diplomats from the U.S. As a kind of like, I don't know, I would call it petty measure just to get back. But, you know, it's sort of like a Trump. Remember, I still have the power here, which I, and I think he's like, it's his way of playing his cards. But like, we don't know what he's dealing with in that deck, though. And I feel like, yeah, it's like, it sounds like a natural reaction to be upset about that. But I feel like we're seeing enough between cybersecurity, which I think we're going to talk about later, and with people getting poisoned with nerve gas. Like I feel like he could do something else if he really wanted to.
Yeah.
And we don't have any a leg to stand on because our president is compromised.
Well, and I think it was interesting, too, because he's losing a lot of people around him. This was in earlier this week. A Trump ally was detained, served with Mueller subpoena at Boston Airport. This is from NBC News by Tom Winter, where he wrote that a professor and author who once presented himself as a possible Trump administration ambassador to the European Union was detained and questioned by the FBI at Boston Logan Airport and served a subpoena from Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who was probing possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Ted Malik said in an emailed statement to the NBC News that he was flying home from his home in the UK via Boston to Cleveland, Ohio, to celebrate Easter when he was stopped Wednesday, an incident first reported by The Guardian. NBC News has independently confirmed that Malik was detained and questioned at the airport, but not the details of the encounter. So this is happening. You have Rick Gates, his former deputy campaign chairman Rick Gates for Trump, was in direct communication with a person he knew was a Russian spy in the weeks ahead of the 2016 election, according to documents filed by Special Counsel Robert Mueller Tuesday. That's from another Vice article by David Gilbert. All these guys are falling. Mm-hmm. Rick Gates is falling. Paul Manafort, Mike Flynn, what's his name? Vanderswamp. What's his name? The lawyer, the Swedish lawyer that's going to jail, that is involved in all this. I think
this is news to me. Sorry.
Vander something lawyer. Anyway, well, there's like a Swedish lawyer who's also involved with this whole thing that is going to jail. All these people are going to jail. He has had no response to Russia other than the White House will deal with it, which is a remarkably casual statement about that. I think it's very clear. It's becoming more and more clear that the president of the United States is compromised.
Well, they've had this fear for a while because news came out this week of some ongoings from a year ago. But this New York Times article, Trump's lawyer raised prospect of pardons for Flynn and Manafort.
Mm-hmm.
This is by Michael S. Schmidt, Joe Becker, Mark Mazzetti, Maggie Haberman, and Adam Goldman. So a lawyer for President Trump broached the idea of Mr. Trump's pardoning two of his former top advisors, Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort, with their lawyers last year, according to three people with knowledge of the discussions. So these discussions came as the special counsel was building cases against both men, and they raised questions about whether the lawyer, John Dowd, who resigned last week, was offering pardons to influence their decisions about whether to plead guilty and cooperate in the investigation. So I don't know why I emphasized it like that, but thank you.
Investigation.
The talk suggests that Mr. Trump's lawyers were concerned about what Mr. Flynn and Mr. Manafort might reveal were they to cut a deal with the special counsel, Robert Mueller, in exchange for leniency. Mm. Mr. Mueller's team could investigate the prospect that Mr. Dowd made pardon offers to thwart the inquiry, although legal experts are divided about whether such offers might constitute obstruction of justice. Like, that's huge, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's huge to find that out. And like I said, there's just been this fear. I think everyone knew they were doing something wrong, and they've known about this for months.
Right.
Months. And so, yeah, so a year ago, they're already trying to figure out ways to get them get presidential pardons. You know, like, this is, like, these guys, they know they're guilty. They know they did these things wrong. They know they tried to deceive the American people. And I don't know why the White House wants to pretend that nothing's wrong.
Well, the thing, too, that, oh, by the way, his name is Alex van der Zwaan. And he is he's a 33-year-old Dutch citizen, and he acknowledged in federal court in Washington that he lied to prosecutors about a September 2016 conversation with Rick Gates. Mm-hmm. So that's from a New York Times article. Yeah. That was his name. But I think
crazy that it was last year. Sorry, I was listening to you talk, and the fact that they were the brain's churning a little slow, even though, you know,
maybe it's a mystery who the one that drank.
I don't
a
think
lot.
It's a mystery.
I don't know.
You know, because my brain's tired from maybe working. Anyways, but
or
a
drinking.
Year ago.
Who knows?
A year. Yeah. Within like the last.
I just felt like we needed to revisit that because that's like That's like them trying to be proactive about mm-hmm. something that they need to be reactive, like that they're already, it's already too far down.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
they know they might need a pardon.
Yeah.
And they're asking like, whoa. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, I'm not a lawyer. I do wonder if this falls under the obstruction of justice category.
Yeah, I don't know.
Sure. Can we, I mean.
I think mm-hmm. that you can, I'm not a lawyer either, but I think you could make an argument that mm-hmm. that's the case. I also think if you listeners are getting into arguments or discussions with people and they say, well, where is the Mueller, report? Why hasn't this happened? I mean, multiple people are going to jail and you don't have a report like that come out just willy-nilly. No one's ever turned in an essay halfway through and expected to get a good grade on it. So I think that's what it's always a countering point if you want to have a conversation with somebody. Because there are a lot of people out there that are going to say, well, where's this report? Where's this report? You have to understand that Robert Mueller is the second longest serving head of the FBI in history behind J. Edgar Hoover, right?
I think so.
Right. Yeah, because he was there for 40 years and then they changed the rule to 10 and then Mueller served the 10 and then was granted 2 extra years because he was so good at his job. He's also a Republican. I just want to I think there's a lot of people that are trying to the Republican Party, the GOP, is trying to dissuade people from trusting the report and ask why it hasn't come out yet.
And what's hard about that too is that the more time passes, the more people are like, well, where's the report? It should be done. Where's the report? It should be done.
Right.
But also the more time passes, we're discovering things. We, meaning they, are discovering things and then also presenting that in a digestible format takes mm-hmm. time, which is totally unfortunate for everybody because we all want answers and da 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 da. Mm-hmm. But that's also what's hard about that. They're not, like you said, they're not just going to release here's our outline of what we found out so far.
No way.
This is, international security relations, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
we're not just going to be, mm-hmm. here are our facts we've got. Anyway, shall we move on?
Yeah. Have we talked about Stormy Daniels on this pod?
Not at length. I think we've briefly mentioned it. What did you want to talk about?
Well, because this is a CNN article from Eli Watkins and Javier de Diego, where they write that Stormy Daniels is going to sue Trump lawyer Michael Cohen for defamation. And then it reads that porn star Stormy Daniels filed a lawsuit for defamation on Monday against President Donald Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen. The suit, filed by her lawyer, Michael Avenatti, in California, came a day after CBS aired a tell-all interview with Daniels regarding an affair she alleges she had with Trump more than a decade ago, and which the White House continues to deny. Oh, that's right. We talked last week about how the interview was going to happen later that day.
Right.
Oh, that's right.
And,
yep.
I will say this about the interview.
What do you think?
Well, first of all, she...
What were your thoughts?
I think she presented everything in just a very matter-of-factual way. To me, it doesn't sound like someone who does it for something to gain. Like, she has nothing to gain out of this, more so than to just get the story out. And I would say, yeah, I everyone was hoping for some sensationalized, oh my gosh, this vile man. But it was the tale of a man who just needs attention.
Yeah, I think
it was weird.
Well, also, everybody making this about the fact that she's a porn star and that he cheated, I think, is the wrong angle to take. I think the correct angle, and what we will be finding out later on, especially because her lawyer has teased that they have evidence of the affair, whether it's a text message
want to see if it's a video.
Right. But what I'm saying is it doesn't matter that she's a porn star, frankly. It doesn't matter that there was an affair, frankly. A lot of presidents have had affairs. That's bad, right? The thing that I think we need to focus on is that she might have blackmail material on the president of the United States. And I think this further corroborates the idea or the notion that the compromat from Russia exists. If he's as careless as he is that some woman that he slept with can have potentially a tape or pictures or any sort of evidence on him, I highly doubt he's, being very careful in Russia in the confines of his hotel room. Mm-hmm. I just think that the porn star thing is sure, it's an angle. Okay, that's going to be the sexy headline. But I think the bigger deal is that there is probably a lot of blackmail material on the current sitting president of the United States out there. Mm-hmm. And that's why he's not talking back to Russia, because they for sure have something. I truly, truly believe that they do.
I'm going to switch subjects.
And rant.
I want to switch subjects real quick because we don't have a specific article about this that we were going to reference. But over the last week, the Parkland students, who are, by the way, are still some of my heroes, and they're some of the coolest people I've ever seen, you know, try to invoke change in this country. But, you know, they're getting a lot of attacks from especially the right, I would say, majority. And, you know, trying to discredit these kids, trying to tell them what Rick Santorum was the one, I think, that said they should learn how to do CPR in case their fellow students get shot, which is. Okay. So
Rick Santorum said he's a nightmare ghoul.
Please do. And then.
Well, I think that all students should learn CPR.
Well, no, learning CPR isn't a problem.
I don't think that's a bad thing. Actually.
Learning a CPR is a problem.
The reason why he said that was an issue. I think the earlier we can start teaching CPR, the better, to be
but
honest.
Like, I'm sick of seeing these people go on TV and say, like, well, who are these kids to try to change our laws? They don't know anything.
Totally. Well, yeah.
But, like, but you're fine with them enlisting and going off to war. You know, they're too young to vote, but yet you feel like they can't have opinions. And then also you have Laura Ingraham this week, who decides to go after David Hogg for not getting into some of the colleges. And he personally tweeted about it, saying that he didn't get into certain colleges. And she Which is a normal thing. But then she takes it upon herself to, like, use that as some sort of attack against him. And, like, why are you attacking a high school student? For what? What do you have to gain from this?
What do you get
from this? And so, luckily, because you forget what generation you're dealing with, he tweets out to his followers, like, hey, these are her advertisers. Go after them. Let them know this is the person they're spending their money on. And she's a bully. And that's exactly what she was. She's being a bully. So now they just announced this weekend, Laura Ingraham, she's taking a week-long break from Fox News because basically, like a bunch of her advertisers pulled out. So I don't know what they're going to do.
I think that's, you know, follow the money.
But I think that's amazing. I don't want to say these kids are impenetrable, but they forget who they're dealing with. These adults that are, like, they're dealing with a generation that can, like, get together within seconds because of social media. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden look at the movement that makes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's 100%.
Yep.
Amazing. I hope to, and I know they did, we talked about this last week and I know that they did do this at the March for Our Lives, but I do hope that, you know, as we are getting so involved in, you know, the Women's March and March for Our Lives, the Parkland kids brought a lot of kids of color up on stage to talk about issues affecting, you know, especially Black communities, mm-hmm. And gun violence. And I think that they were doing a good job of that. I think more needs to be done in terms of that, because they have been getting a lot of attention, mm-hmm. Because, you know, this was a big school shooting and they had access to Twitter and they used their social media accounts and they're doing a lot of amazing things. I just hope that in the future we also come out for other marches.
Well, yes.
Black Lives Matter, that sort of thing.
Because even the Parkland students were talking about that. The Parkland students of color, they, you know, when they were talking about preventative measures and saying, like, oh, if we should have more gun presence in the schools, they're saying no, because when it comes, look what it's happening outside.
Yeah.
People getting shot in their backyards holding cell phones. What do you think is going to happen if there's a school shooter and then they're just a teacher just shoots a black kid just because, like, oh, I thought, know, and, like, we don't need those excuses to start happening inside the classroom too. So there's definitely some voices that need to be heard as we change things. And yes, we do work on the security, but we also work on, you know, getting guns out of areas. I think those are big.
Yeah. And I think circling back to our interviews with Jennifer Hoppe, also emphasizing safe gun practices. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she talked about storing the gun and the ammunition not loaded in separate places, full stop. You know, getting actually, I don't know how you enforce that. And I think that's something that we're all grappling with. But, you know, if you're going to have a gun, at least keep it safe.
I think
don't keep it loaded. Even if you have children and you tell them not to touch the gun, it doesn't matter.
I think in Sweden it is. I could be wrong on this. Email us if I'm wrong. I think in Sweden they have a thing where anyone's allowed to own a gun, but nobody can keep ammunition in their house. Mm-hmm. So, like, ammunition is kept at, like, a shooting range or, like, a hunting place.
Right.
But nobody, so everyone's allowed to have a gun. You can have a gun. You just can't have any ammunition. I think that's an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. There was the buyback program in Australia after they had their mass shooting. Anyway, my whole point on this is because earlier this week, some African-American teens from Parkland came and they did a press conference and 10 channels showed up, I think, and like 8 of them were local. And they were like, you know, we don't necessarily agree with our fellow students on all of their positions. We don't agree with guns, like what James was saying. And nobody really covered them. So I think it's important that we do cover that. It's important. There are a lot of viewpoints out there. Teachers should not have guns in schools. You know, also Samantha Bee's doing great stuff with Puerto Rico. I thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. People, you know, keep donating to Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Because getting involved. Sorry, that was like a weird side note, but just thinking about it.
All right. So I think we should move on to the female senators. So this article came out on March 28th by Elise Vibeck in the Washington Post. It's titled Female Senators Demand Rule Change to Address Sexual Harassment in Congress. So the
my microphone fell and it was like, it was telling, it was like, enough, man.
It was.
No more male presence. Just
it was very symbolic. Even though you're a great male ally.
Hey, thank
Anyways,
you.
The women of the Senate demanded on Wednesday that leaders allow votes to improve Capitol Hill's system for reporting and adjudicating complaints of sexual harassment and other workplace misconduct after such changes were already excluded from a recent major spending bill. So the letter is excellent. It starts with, it doesn't start with, but a quote from the letter is, "The time has come to rewrite the CAA to provide a more equitable process that supports survivors of harassment and discrimination. Inaction is unacceptable when a survey shows that 4 out of 10 women congressional 10 women congressional staffers believe that sexual harassment is a problem on Capitol Hill, and 1 out of every 6 women in the same survey responded that they have been survivors of sexual harassment. No longer can we allow the perpetrators of these crimes to hide behind this 23-year-old law. The House approved changes to the underlying law last month, barring sexual relationships between lawmakers and their employees, canceling the requirement that accusers undergo counseling and medication, and requiring members to reimburse the Treasury Department when they are involved in settlements, among other provisions. The female senators noted that as a result of the House vote, staffers in lower chambers have access to free legal representation during the complaint process, which I think is huge. And the Senate must ask the Senate must act quickly to provide Senate staff the same resources as their House colleagues. So, yeah, I mean, this is actual action after this whole, I mean, again, I love the Time's Up movement, Me Too, et cetera, but also, you know, it's like kind of like we were just talking about with the marches, like we need to march, we need to have the mass social media things, we need the numbers, we need the things, but then also we need the change. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually a step, small step, I think, in the right direction. And it's cool to see the female senators coming together.
And it's weird to see something as common sense as like women should be paid. They should be treated equally. Like these shouldn't be things we should have to keep reminding people in 2018. And yet we have, but, and I'm glad it's a small step that has been made, but like, I'm sad that it's a small step. Like why can't,
but also I've recently, I've been talking to one of my female coworkers about this, that we have to take like every small W. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just going to remain very sad and depressing.
Yeah.
So I think I'm sure other women are at completely different places. But with this particularly, I'm just like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
I'll take it. I'm not happy. I don't think it's fixed, but it's a small W. Next thing, you know, next topic, next fight. Anyways.
Well, actually, it's very interesting that you say that, because speaking of that small step and small fights. So a slight setback. This is a NBC News article. LGBTQ Americans won't be counted in the 2020 U.S. Census after all. This is an article by Mary Emily O'Hara. LGBTQ advocacy groups are outraged after proposed questions regarding sexual orientation and gender identity were quickly removed Tuesday from a just-released draft of the 2020 U.S. Census. The U.S. Census Bureau, which is part of the Department of Commerce, is required to issue a list of categories it plans to track 3 years before the survey is conducted. Tuesday's list showed categories ranging from race and gender to the type of plumbing in homes and the length of a person's daily commute to work. Each category is followed by a table showing the federal agencies that rely on the data to make decisions about law enforcement, healthcare, equal employment opportunities, and more. No previous U.S. census has ever included LGBTQ Americans, which makes
read that again?
Like
no previous U.S. census has ever included LGBTQ Americans, meaning they basically had to pick male or female.
Mm-hmm.
And and it didn't track sexual orientation.
And it, but also what that falls into is like when it comes into law enforcement, when you're talking about
healthcare, laws around like who can see you when you die, you know, it has such cascading effects.
And so this is when people say like, what do you mean you're underrepresented?
Literally, I am not represented. Yes.
Like there's no statistical data that's like helping like to represent your community. So these are the kind of types of things we're talking about. In addition, the more detailed American Community Survey also leaves out LGBTQ categories. So this initial release from the Census Bureau proposed including lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people on both surveys. So
it's crazy. Yeah. And then also there's another article about CNN Politics about California's response to this. So obviously we all live in California, or not obviously. The three of us live in California, but I'm hoping other states might take some action. But this is an article called "California Sues Over Census Citizenship Question." Ooh, say that five times fast. The progressive states and civil rights advocates are preparing a flurry of legal challenges to the Trump administration's decision to add a question about citizenship in the next census, saying the move will penalize immigrants and threaten civil rights. So. The move was laid on Monday by the Commerce Department and said that in response to the request by the Justice Department, it would restore a question about citizenship that has not appeared on the census since the 1950s. The administration said the data was necessary to enforce the 1965 voting rights. So the state of California immediately challenged the plan in federal court. And trashed the move as anti-immigrant. Quote, the citizenship question is the latest attempt by President Trump to stoke the fires of anti-immigrant hostility. Now in one fell swoop, the U.S. Commerce Department has ignored its own protocols of years of preparations in a concerted effort to suppress a fair and accurate census count from our diverse communities. So this is, again, similarly to LGBTQ community, this is another step that's like, we're just not going to track the data. Mm-hmm. So then we can't have those different communities make claims on we're X percent of the population or we're X blah, 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 blah. Like mm-hmm. however they need, because so much of funding gets circled back to the census count.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. Anyways, I think we should.
Well, I want to do one quick thing. Okay. Yes. So there was a New York Times article that came out, I think this week or late last week. And it says they protest and many activists privately suffer as a result. And it's by John Elegon. I highly recommend you read it. It talks about Erica Garner. And it talks about activists, and we talk about this a lot of having good mental health and like, you know, trying to keep good vibes around yourself. There are a lot of activists out there. I mean, Erica Garner was 27 when she passed away, which is my age. So it's scary to think about that. There is a lot of stress that activists undergo, whether they're the Parkland teens, whether they're people that we interview on this podcast. So get involved in these movements. And when you do, it's really important to always add your name, your face, your body to the movement. But it's also very important to take time for yourself and to breathe and to lift yourself up and to count little victories when they happen. Because a lot of activists out there are under immense, immense stress. So get involved, but also take time for yourself and read this article, because Erica Garner needs to be talked about a lot more than she is. And a lot of activists out there that are fighting in Ferguson, you know, doing amazing things and putting themselves on the front line, need to be talked about and celebrated. So
great. All right. Well, we are really excited about our interview with my good friend, Devin Toth Godot. She is a effectiveness coach at the New Teacher Project and previously a principal and previously with Teach for America. And she's going to jump into all things education with us, and we're super excited. So stick around.
Yeah.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to our interview. I'm so excited. We're having on one of my close friends. Even though I not only missaid her last name, I also said the wrong title. So that's two strikes against me. But we're welcoming Devin Toth Godot. Jesus Christ almighty.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Who is the site manager of TNTP, which is also known as the New Teachers Project. So Devin, hey girl.
Hey, how's it going?
It's great. I am so excited to have you on because I feel like I've seen your career as a friend kind of take a trajectory. And so I'm excited to hear more from, I guess you might say, the professional perspective. But we're going to start with something general. I just want to know, and I don't think I've ever asked you this. So what was the point in your life where you knew you had to go into education? Like, was there some sort of class or tipping point where you were like, this is my fight? And when was that?
It's a really great question. Also, it feels a little apropos that it is Easter today. Because it goes back to my roots at a Jesuit college. So I graduated from the College of the Holy Cross for my undergrad, and I basically got a great education. Our motto is men and women for others. And so everything that we did in classes, everything, you know, student life and things of that nature were really geared toward this, like, what are you going to do in your life that's going to benefit others? And I got to senior year. I had for a really long time thought that I was going to be a lawyer, and that was what I knew. And decided senior year that that actually wasn't really what I wanted to do, and so ended up in this place where I was kind of floating out there, knew that I wanted to do something focused on serving others, helping others, and basically knew a bunch of people who had gone on to Teach for America recruitment events or done Teach for America, went to one recruitment event and was completely and went into this motor. This is what I want to do. I want to use my knowledge, my love for education, my love of learning to actually impart that on students who might not have, who might not have an opportunity to receive the same level of education and opportunity. And so since then, became a teacher, taught in Dallas Independent School District for several years, loved that, loved my kids, probably could have taught forever, ended up coming out of the classroom as a fluke, kind of. So the principal, one of my principals at one point was basically like, I need you to come out of the classroom, support other teachers, which is how I moved out of a classroom setting. And into doing more of what I do now, which is teacher support, development, coaching, that sort of thing. And then, kind of took a little bit of a turn, went back into schools and was an assistant principal back in Dallas for about a year and a half. And now kind of back to TNP for my second time around and am doing lots of really diverse work right now with them. But the whole... the whole point of that is when you get into a classroom, kids get under your skin. And so I think, I thought I could be, thought I could do Teach for America. That's really what I wanted to do. And then when I had my own classroom full of kids, I was like, I never want to do anything else. Like, I want to serve these kids. I want to serve like them. I want to support them. I want to make them their own advocate. I want to give them opportunities. And so it's something that just gets in your blood, and it's really hard to,
to get away from it, basically. Yeah. So what do you think? I should say probably in your time with Teach for America, since that's a big learning experience for a lot of people, just starting out, wanting to know if they do want to pursue a career in education like that. And I wonder, what did you see already, on that base level of seeing, this is how classrooms are running, and wow, we really need to change this. Like, these kids aren't getting this access. What are some things that you noticed in that?
Yeah. There's so much we could go into, right? I think when you step into a classroom for the first time, particularly in a classroom of students who have been historically underserved, there is a moment where you realize how far behind they are in many ways in terms of what you would think of as general knowledge, basic academic ability, things like that. And then you also realize at the same time how incredibly resilient they are, how far ahead they are in so many ways, and how much they deserve to have experiences that they haven't yet had. And so, you know, I can throw out some examples, but I taught my very first year in the classroom, taught remedial reading to a group of ninth graders in a high school in South Dallas. I had kids in ninth grade who were reading on a third grade level, who were reading on a fourth grade level, some who were completely unable to, you know, to have any phonemic awareness. So like, on kindergarten level, like I had kids who couldn't decode words in that remedial reading class. And so when you think about, when I thought back to my experience in ninth grade, which was like I was in Juliet without any supports, and coming back and discussing it in class and writing essays on it. And then you think about kids who, you know, should be able to have that experience, but because of their previous experiences, they don't even have the skills to be able to like jump in and do that. It makes you want to dig in, right? And I think if you ask any teacher, they will tell you like it's really disheartening at first, and it can be frustrating, and it can start to burn you out. But it is also the fire that you keep in your belly every single day. It's just like, I have to do better for these kids because they deserve to have those experiences.
And I feel like that example is very much a metaphor for a lot of the education system, one might say. You know, I mean, obviously, I know a lot from Katie and you. But how do you balance that with in a building, you know, you have broken chairs that they're sitting on. And so not only can they not read, they don't have anywhere to sit. And then also you don't have funding and you don't have XYZ. So how do we start like filling those cracks, or where's the root of the problem? Cause it's all over the system.
I think it's a great question. And I actually don't think that there's one place that you start to dig in. And I think that's mirrored in the work that we do at TNTP. So we are a national nonprofit. We were founded by teachers, you know, 10, 20 years ago. The work that we did was really focused on at the teacher level and only at the teacher level. So it started with like staffing and getting a great teacher into every single classroom that we possibly could through like staffing practices, which is one root cause, right? You need, that's where the rubber meets the road, is having a great teacher in a classroom that like has that fire in their belly. But we realized as we've evolved as an organization that there are policy issues at play here. There are funding issues at play. There are, you know, districts, systems levels at play, you know, on and on and on and on, community engagement and like family issues. And so what we now try to do is basically partner with districts and partner with other, you know, other entities, whether it's, you know, State Department of Education, or we do some work at the national level as well, to really help them solve like their most pressing problems at any level of the system. So to give you an example of that, like, yes, funding is definitely an issue. You can have like broken chairs and, you know, the things that is, you know, kids need to feel safe and they need to feel like they're in an environment that reflects what they need to do when they're in a classroom. But there's also a question of like, if you have a great teacher in a classroom and they have that fire in their belly, but they don't have materials to work with that actually allow them to give kids experiences like reading Romeo and Juliet and having a rich discussion and all of those things, then that teacher is going to spend an inordinate amount of time going out and trying to like gather the materials that they need, build those lessons. And then you have teachers who are stressed out, burned out, and don't have the time to actually take care of themselves or take care of students' needs in the classroom. Again, like same thing with counseling, right? We've heard so much in the news recently about, you know, school counselors and how do we take care of the mental health of kids? So all of that to say, there are multiple entry points. And when I think about like the whole ed reform landscape over the last, 10, 15, 20 years, I feel like a lot of organizations have basically said, like, we're going to pick this thing and this is what we're going to work at because we believe that this is the root cause. I don't necessarily think that there is one root cause. I think the entire system is broken, and we really need to look at it from multiple angles and start to fix, you know, whatever problem. Yeah, I think this goes to when I think about your audience, like whatever you do and you do well, right? There's a place for you to plug into this because there are so many aspects of the system that are broken.
I'm curious now, you were talking too about just now about how hard it can be, you know, if a teacher has the materials, but doesn't have the materials rather, and is trying to help, and it can be exhausting. Is there also, we were just talking about activists and their mental health. And you know, we talk about students and their mental health. How much of a focus is also on teachers and them wanting, you know, to succeed in situations where it's very hard to do so?
Yeah, that is a huge gap in a lot of the work that's happening right now is teacher mental health, to be completely honest. And I don't think that we listen to teachers enough, to be very frank. In like general. In our political landscape, in our economic landscape, we tend to like leave teachers out of the conversation a whole lot. We don't ask them what they need a lot. And if we do, we don't listen. we generally are like, okay, yeah, no, we hear you. This is what you need. And we're actually not having a nuanced conversation about what does your mental health look like? I think, you know, great examples of that are what has happened in West Virginia, what's about to happen in Oklahoma, and what's happening in Arizona as well right now. So when we think about, you know, teachers getting to the point where, and that's a really, by the way, the strikes that are happening, that's a really difficult situation for a teacher to be in. If you have been in a classroom, you know how important learning time for kids, and you know how difficult it is to leave your students for any length of time because you know what that gap in their learning time can mean. Having that dichotomy of like, I have to take care of my kid, but I also need to take care of me. And that may mean stepping outside the classroom, and you know, going out and protesting for like actually decent wages or healthcare or, you know, all of the things that I need to survive. That's a terrible choice for a teacher to have to make, to be quite honest. And it's something where I'm really encouraged by teachers standing up and asking to be heard. And I really hope that one of the things that comes out of this is not just better wages, better health care, all of the actual, the main, like, you know, basic demands that people are asking for, but also that we start the teachers a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And actually, we don't want it to get to this point anymore. You're one of our most important assets. How can we do better for you? And what do you need?
I'm curious then, because I agree with so much of what you're saying. So, but one person I don't think that views that the same way is Betsy DeVos. So I'm wondering what has her effect been on the teaching profession and what you guys do as well?
So I think, you know, there have been some really encouraging things that came out of the legislature this week. So a lot of the cuts that she proposed, are not going to happen. And actually the legislature has decided that they are going to fund, like actually add funding to a lot of the programs that she wanted to cut. So I think like on a day-to-day operations level, it doesn't affect us a whole lot. The work that I do and in schools, the major effect is actually on like, going back to the mental health of teachers, going back to, you know, just the culture in schools and kind of how folks who work in education feel about how they are valued. Mm-hmm. I think the way that we're talking about school choice right now, the way that we're talking about, you know, like teachers get villainized, right? Like we constantly say teachers need to do better. You know, public schools aren't serving our kids. So we need to, you know, parents need to have the opportunity to, you know, choose schools for their kids. And don't get me wrong. Like, I think that there are places where school choice definitely works. Mm-hmm. But this idea that we're saying in some ways the system and teachers themselves and the people who are doing this really difficult work are failing, it gets to you and it affects the work because it basically kind of, I don't know, like you start to feel like I'm not valued. as a teacher, as an educator, as someone who does this work, and I think especially when you have somebody in that role as Secretary of Education who's never done the work, mm-hmm. and never actually experienced that. I think it's one thing to say, like, there are problems in the system when you have lived and worked and really, like, dug in the system. I think it's totally different to hear from someone who has never been a teacher, who has never, you know, spent a significant amount of time inside a public school, that you are failing at a job that you are working really hard at and really want to tell.
And I think part of what's so hard about that is, in a lot of ways, a lot of teachers are set up to fail. And so you can have an incredible teacher come into a classroom and have to, you know, work five or six times as hard because the system has delivered a fail, basically. And so I'm curious, you know, circling back to TNTP, it looks like you kind of have four categories of what you do: advice, data, design, and execution. And so what do you, as a site manager, what is your job? But also, you know, what is TNTP pushing forward?
Of what we're pushing forward through the work that I've just recently done, and then share a little bit about kind of what I'm doing personally right now, because I think it gets to the heart of this, like, you know, setting teachers up to fail and how we're really trying to, like, move beyond that and set them up for success. So in terms of where TNTP is as an organization and where we're going, we, as I kind of alluded to earlier, we do a lot of things. We plug in at a lot of different places in the system. But one of the things that we've noticed over the past few years is there's a really important voice that's missing from the conversation about education and education reform, and that's the voice of the student, right?
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
Right, like, we generally have a bunch of adults in the room talking about what kids need in school. We very rarely are actually pulling kids in and saying, what do you need? What do you need? What do you want? What are your experiences in school? And, you know, how are you feeling about what you're doing? And so we have started to think in the organization, not just about how are we continuing to do the work that we've been doing for years, which is supporting districts, supporting schools, really working on making supporting policy landscapes that support teachers and schools and all of those things. But also now, like, how do we bring students into this conversation, and how do we, you know, make sure that there are communities and that we're engaging with communities and things like that to support students. So the work that I most recently did was we put out kind of every few years a report, like a research report on something in the field that feels really elevate. And so we have a report that'll be coming out in September of 2018 this year that really basically, like, wants to elevate student voice and say, this is, we talked to a whole bunch of kids, we looked at their experiences in school, here's what they say about what's happening in schools right now and what we actually need to do to support them better. So I, we did close to 1,000 full-time classroom observations. We talked to students, we talked to teachers, we pulled work samples from each classrooms that we worked in. The report itself dealt with 5 districts across the country, so 4 diverse public districts and then 1 charter management organization. We have about 60 teachers across grade levels and content areas in each district. And then also, the coolest part of the report was, yes, we interviewed students, but we also had students take real-time surveys in their classes. So we basically, like, gave them a potty training watch, and the watch would vibrate at a particular time in class. When the watch vibrated, they would actually stop what they were doing and take a survey about how they were feeling, what they were learning, you know, what they were working on, et cetera, et cetera. So we could really amass a whole bunch of data about how students were feeling in their day-to-day, you know, classroom life. And so that's kind of what we're thinking about as an organization. There are some things that came up in that, which I think are really important, and we've talked a lot about already, which is you know, based on a lot of this data, and obviously I can't share like nuances or details of the report, but based on the data, it goes to a lot of what we've already talked about. Teachers are doing what they know how to do and what they have capacity to do to really support their students and do their jobs. Students are by and large doing what we ask of them, and they believe that what they're doing is going to help them achieve their goals. Students basically say, like, I do what I need to do in class, what's being asked of me, because I have big aspirations for myself, and I think if I know what's being put in front of me, I'm going to get there. But ultimately, like, those two things are not adding up to students having experiences that are going to set them up to, like, meet grade level standards and ultimately reach their goals. So what we see is, like, kids who are doing what we're asking them to do, but the work that they're actually doing in class is far below what they should be doing at a particular grade level, are not aligned to the things that they need to know and be able to do to be college and career ready. And so as an organization, we're really thinking about this idea of, like, teachers are working really hard, students are working really hard, but there's something missing that is holding back students from having these really strong experiences in the classroom that are going to set them up for success. So we work at a lot of different levels to kind of close that gap. One of them is a curriculum. So we're thinking about how do we support districts in adopting really strong curriculum so that teachers don't have to go out and spend a significant amount of time, like, building lessons, building materials, like trying to plug holes in materials, when what they should be thinking about is how do I get my kids from, like, where they are right now to actually being able to meet the standards. We're also training teachers on what does the standards actually say? What do kids actually need to be able to do at the end of the day to put them on a path to being college ready? Teachers work so hard. They do so much. They're asked to be mentor, colleague, brother, sister, friend, their mom, dad, in some cases, in addition to actually being the person imparting knowledge in the room. And so a lot of times, you know, we provide teachers these professional development experiences where we're like, okay, here's what you need to do. Go do it. It'll be great. And then we leave them on their own to try and figure it out, in addition to all of these other, you know, major things that they're dealing with on a day-to-day with, you know, 30 kids in a classroom. So we're also supporting teachers in figuring out, like, what are best instructional practices? What, you know, how can I get my kid to read and analyze a complex piece of text and be able to talk about it in a meaningful way. So that kind of goes to the work that I do right now. So I've moved off this national report work and am now supporting two separate contracts, both of them in secondary schools. So in one, I work with a subset of schools, middle schools in Florida, and I'm actually supporting their teacher leaders in English language arts to improve instructional practices in their English classes. So I work directly with the instructional leader, teacher coach, whomever it is at that campus. We provide them content on, like, best instructional practices. And then that person takes and turns around that content to the teachers. Teachers are then engaging in these cycles where they're based on the content, based on what they're learning, professional development sessions, they get to make choices about what they want to try in their classrooms. And then they go back, try it. They get to talk about it. They have the opportunity to really learn and engage in professional learning that is kind of real time, right? It takes into account what's happening in class. So that's one of them. And then in the other contract, I do something similar. So I'm working with teachers and teacher leaders to help them understand, like, what college and career readiness looks like for kids, what are the steps, how to kind of shift through. So there's, you know, there's a lot in there, and that's, like, a very small subset of what's happening within the organization right now. There's also policy work being done. We still have teacher fellows programs where we're training new teachers, all sorts of kind of different aspects of the system. But a lot of that is, like, how do we support teachers to get what they need, and then how are we starting to think about elevating voice so that students can advocate and say, this is what I need, and then how do we help them get there?
I feel like there's so much to do.
There's a lot to do.
The fight is never over.
I feel like you could have a staff, I don't know how big your staff is, but you could have a staff of like a million people and still need more people.
Yeah. I mean, we're a staff of 400, right? And we're one organization and out of many that is working in the ed reform space right now.
Right.
And there's still a ton of work to be done.
Wow. So I think with that, I think we'll first have to have you come back on to dig deeper into some of these topics, because I feel like we've just like scraped the surface. But with that, you know, what are some calls to action for our listeners? Obviously, following TNTP and digging into what you do, it would be great. But is there anything specific, you know, that our listeners can think about or do that would help support your work?
Yeah. So I think a really simple thing that people can do to support all of this work is to reevaluate kind of where your opinions about education come from. So stop basing your opinions about education based on your education.
That's huge. Wow.
And actually talk to the people who are in it every day. Whether that's a teacher or, I think more importantly, a student, there are always opportunities for you to engage with a kid who is in an elementary, middle, high school classroom and ask them, what are you learning? Is it important? What could be done differently? And then how can I help advocate for you? How can I help you advocate for yourself? Those are things that don't often get done and I think are really simple. Like, talk to a kid, talk to a teacher, ask them what you can do in some small way. And I think this is such an important moment to do that. There are so many things that are happening in the political landscape right now that I think you can plug into in a really meaningful and like low-lift way. You don't have to go out and march. Like, obviously go out and march if you want to. Go out and support your protests who are protesting for better wages, better healthcare, all of the things. But it can be as simple as talking to a kid, asking them what they need, and then helping them get what they need. So also, you know, take a look in September of 2018 for TNTP's new national report. That will actually include some like very concrete examples of actions that you can take to support, you know, instructional quality in the classroom, helping kids meet their goals and aspirations.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Just so much to do.
So much to do.
We love it.
Thank you for coming on.
Yes. Thanks, Devin, for coming on.
If you guys want to check out our stuff, you can email us at werebelpodcast@gmail.com or WeRebel on Apple Podcasts, @WeRebel on Twitter and Instagram. We love hearing from you. If you want, give us a rating, give us a comment. We definitely enjoy those, even the mean ones. So,
and visit tntp.org to find out more about what Devin's up to. And they've got all the social medias right there at the top right, ready for you to follow. Amazing.
Great.
Great. Happy April Fool's Day, everybody.
Happy April Fool's Day. Happy birthday, Mom. Thanks
Happy
for coming
Happy birthday,
on.
Nick's mom.
She's the best. All right. See you guys next week.
Bye.
Campfire.
Hi, I'm Winston.
And I'm David.
And we're the hosts of a new podcast on Campfire Media called Try It, You'll Like It.
And on our podcast, we have our guests eat a food they hate one last time.
And we have so many crazy guests.
We got amazing chefs.
We have killer comedians.
Bakers.
Candlestick makers.
Distillers.
Brewers.
Food writers.
Oh, they're writing about food.
Ooh, they're probably having some food while they're writing about that food.
Because we're eating food, and they're eating food, and you're listening to It Happen.
All you ASMR hits, enjoy. Chomp chomp.
So check it out every Thursday at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Mmm, that was good. Yeah.